Hello, everybody. Welcome to Free Kiwis. Today we have our New Zealand Initiative colleague with us, who is Dr. Eric Crampton. And Eric, you received a PhD from George Mason University, I think, in economics.
Yes, ages ago.
Ages ago. And how long have you been at the initiative?
I got here in 2014.
Okay, so a while already. So welcome to Free Kiwis. I guess you've produced a lot of reports for the initiative. I wanted to start out with one called Democracy in the Dark, which is from a couple of years ago, I think, 2020. And this was based partly on a survey that you did of sort of basic political knowledge among New Zealanders. So do you want to just summarize what happened with that project? What did you find?
Sure. This has been a longstanding interest of mine. So going back further in a prior academic life, I was a lecturer and senior lecturer at the University of Canterbury in economics. And there I'd done some work using the New Zealand Election Survey to see what Kiwis knew about civics and whether it mattered for anything. We followed up on it in a survey here with the initiative, looking more at civic knowledge. And turns out that Kiwis really don't know that much about how their system of government works. So you'll have the numbers in front of you there. I haven't got them in front of me here, but simply put, there is very little reason for anybody to really know anything about how the voting system works, eligibility for voting, how parliament works, how the system of government works, checks and balances, any of that. Civic knowledge winds up being rather low because it's costly to get, not so much in the sense of money, but in time and effort and pain in trying to figure it all out. And there's not really much benefit in it unless you are in that game. So you can go through your whole life knowing nothing about how the system works and be absolutely no worse off for it other than maybe making some bad investment decisions if they were particularly subject to political risk.
Yeah, it comes as no great surprise to me that New Zealanders don't know too much about the system, because the New Zealand school curriculum is a very open document. There's nothing in it that mandates the teaching of this stuff. And some of the research that you cite in the report suggests that even if we did, it doesn't help much. I think some American research compared areas where civics was taught with areas that it wasn't, and it didn't make much difference to how much students knew or how much people knew.
Yeah, it's fairly longstanding. So again, going back to my time at Canterbury, I taught public choice. So there it was a 300 level econ paper, and then I did it at the honors level as well. In the public choice paper for undergrads, all of the literature on this stuff is based on American institutions, because most of the academic work on it is done in the United States. So there it looks at how the division of powers works. It's very different in a presidential system compared to a parliamentary system. And I thought when I started lecturing there in 2003, 2004, that the first job was going to be just explaining first differences between the American system and the New Zealand system, so that they'd have a handle on how to relate the concepts between the two systems. I expected that they knew their own system and that they just needed a little bit of help with the American system, which would be naturally unfamiliar because, like, why would you know that, right? It's a foreign system. But that sure wasn't going to cut it. They didn't know anything about their own political system either. So I would have to brief them up on that. It was always a bit of fun because I would start off by providing these surveys of evidence on what Americans know about their political system, about civics, about their place in the international system, and sort of inviting the Kiwi students to make fun of the Americans, because they love doing that, right? Kiwis mm-hmm. love thinking they're morally and physically and mentally superior to anybody else, and especially the Americans. So they always would want any opportunity to dump on the Americans. So I'd invite them to do that for a little while. And then I'd put up some of the data from the New Zealand Election Survey showing that Kiwis are every bit as ignorant about their basic civics and their political and economic structures as Americans. And then they'd look a little bit downcast. And then I'd remind them, well, it's kind of rational to be ignorant about this stuff.
Yeah, can I just highlight one figure I found particularly astounding? Is, you're right, George Mason University law professor Ilya Salman's review of the literature.
I love that one.
Found only 38% of Americans in 1964 knew that the Soviet Union was not a member of the NATO alliance.
Yes. Yeah, so this is like right after the Cuban Missile Crisis. The establishment of NATO should have been, in living memory, came out after the Second World War to protect the West against the Soviets. People kind of forgot that. It's just bizarre, right?
Yeah, so I know a little bit of this literature, especially the American literature, Brian Kaplan and people like that. So I guess my worry about it is just sort of where is it going? Because you might think it's sort of dumping on the demos in a sense. You know, it's looking at what people know in America or in New Zealand, and then could that be taken in a rather undemocratic direction? I mean, presumably you're not saying people don't know anything. Let's, you know, just take the vote away from them or something like that. So what what kind of conclusions do these figures draw you towards?
I think that it should lead us to be a little bit more skeptical about the inputs into the democratic process and realistic in our expectations about what we can achieve that way. So for me, a bottom line is that we need to make it really, really simple for voters to know who's to blame if something goes wrong, or who to reward if they like current outcomes. It should be dead simple for a voter to look out the window, decide that they like what they see, or they don't like what they see, and know who to reward or punish for it. So from that perspective, I kind of like first-past-the-post systems, where you tend to have majority governments that are easier to punish or reward for sets of outcomes. The American system does have that, but it also has additional complexities where it's hard to know whether to blame state and local government or central government or Congress versus the president or which branch of Congress. I'd done a little bit of work with Brian Kaplan and Ilya and Wayne Groves on apportioning responsibility in the U.S. system. So there we had a survey of expert political scientists and the public more generally, and the political science experts were experts in American politics, just asking them which level and branch of government was most responsible for a wide variety of outcomes. So we listed them all in series, things like current inflation rates, current state of the economy, local crime rates, the quality of the education system, those sorts of things. And what we found there was that voters tended to overblame governments for everything and to diffuse responsibility across all agencies. So if something is going wrong, they're going to blame government very broadly, even for things that are often going to be outside of the government's control, but blame indiscriminately because it was too hard to tell who to blame. So you just kind of lash out at everything. There'd been some other work suggesting, like, studies showing that incumbents do worse if the state football team's doing poorly, like just dumb stuff like that, right?
People's mood matters as much as the ideas or the events.
Well, that'll come in, but you can make sense of it a bit through a generalized heuristic of retrospective voting, that if you look out the window and things are basically going well and you don't know really why, if they're going well, stick with the incumbent, and if they're going poorly, mix it up. That's not a crazy heuristic. There are far better ones, but it might be the best that we can actually hope for in a informationally constrained environment.
Yeah. I'd like to come back to the question of education here a little bit, because while I think, you know, it would be desirable for people to know more about the system in which they're operating and you know, the factual knowledge of how Parliament works and voting and so on, I think there's another element to it that we need to consider as well, which is what I would call the democratic dispositions, the ability to contest ideas, the ability to discuss things without rancor and to seek to have one's thinking improved through disagreement rather than seeing that as an acrimonious thing. And I wonder, I've been thinking for a long time about how one could do this, and it seems to me the best way is to start with young people in schools and teach them how that works and give them practice in doing it. I wonder what you think about that and how you think that stacks up alongside the explicit knowledge of the system that you've been talking about.
I'm not averse to it, and I'm certainly not averse to experimenting with it. I've seen work suggesting that civics education in particular doesn't really do that much. So on the one hand, some of the worries that you might have that teachers are indoctrinating students into one ideology or another, that seems to wash out. There is an experiment that they'd run where they were trying to improve a civic understanding of elements of the U.S. Constitution, and it didn't stick, right? Like, you'll remember it for the test, and then it washes out not that long later. So on the one hand, it's not so bad if you're mainly worried that teachers are going to be indoctrinating students. But I have not seen work looking at deliberate efforts to inculcate an ethos of debate and discussion and, that kind of basic civics going back to the old Greeks that you guys will know more about than I do. There might be work that's been done on it, but I'm just not familiar with it.
Well, there is actually some quite new work based on a theory out of psychology called the theory of argumentative reasoning. And this theory stipulates that, or predicts or hypothesizes is the better way to put it, that the reason that human beings evolved to be able to reason is a social one. In other words, rather than driving an ability for us to individually make decisions, it arose so that we could compare ideas, and because we're actually much better at criticizing other people's arguments than we are at criticizing our own. And consequently, when we're together and arguing in good faith and we have in mind the improvement of ideas, we make more progress than we do when we just sit quietly and think on our own. So it seems to me that there's a clue in that for how we might help children to learn to participate in democracy rather than just know about the system, which may seem important too. But
no, it seemed like a great idea for kids to learn how to engage in that. But these processes don't always go well either, right? So deliberative processes can go off the rails. So if everybody comes in with a civics ethos and they are committed truth seekers and that's what they want to do, well, then that's all great. And if you've been able to inculcate it, that's great. But the process of deliberation itself doesn't necessarily lead to good outcomes either, right? So there is the set of experiments that were run by Cass Sunstein ages back, where I think the paper is called What Happened on Deliberation Day. So that was a response to some of the arguments around deliberative democracy and this ideal where if we just put people in smaller rooms together and let them hash it out, and they're all going to be motivated in the way that you've just described, so they're going to try and find this truth, and that will reach us to some magical consensus. Well, what Sunstein found was it was a jury experiment. So he impaneled sets of juries where they were all given the same set of facts about a case and told to deliberate over the extent of a verdict, that how much penalty should be applied from zero to some arbitrarily large number. They surveyed jury members going into the deliberation to ask them what they thought the penalty should be. And then they randomly assorted them across juries. I can't remember if it was 9 or 12 that they used, and looked at who the median was across those, because you'd expect the deliberation might lead you to a median voter outcome in some cases. What he found instead was a severity shift, where if you had groups that had a lot of people who kind of wanted low penalties applied, or groups that wanted a lot of high penalties applied, the group consensus went to the extremes of either of those rather than finding moderation. So he called it the severity shift in deliberative politics. That sort of thing worries me when I see calls for deliberative democracy coming up in, for example, the Future for Local Government Forum, arguing for this kind of mechanism for changing local politics. I don't know if you've ever been to a town hall meeting on housing. These guys just ramp themselves up in hating housing more rather than trying to find consensus.
Yeah, I mean, that can certainly happen. It seems to me it's a little bit different in a large body politic than it is in a jury, because in a jury, it's a small number of people. You're more likely to end up with a cadre of people in there with strong views one way or another who may drag the whole thing in a certain direction, whereas where if you have a much larger group, then it's going to be much more likely to be balanced and have a middle. I don't know what effect that would have, but it's a question.
I guess it depends partly, too, on what you think the point of the exercise is. If you're trying to use it as a truth discovery mechanism for finding an empirical fact of the world, I suspect that it fails, and I think that there are much better ways of doing that. I really like prediction markets for that purpose. If instead you're trying to find generalized agreement to some outcome that everybody can try and live with, well, you're going to have a harder time doing that through a prediction market, and that would take some kind of agreement process.
Yeah.
So I suppose it depends on the kind of question that you're asking, you're dealing with, because it strikes me that with these kind of very empirical questions, you know, you can tell from the get-go what kind of answer is correct. But one of the things I've noticed about these studies of deliberative polling, there's often an idea that we should get certain answers. I mean, in Sunstein's case, it seems to be that he prefers to get moderation, so then he observes polarization, and that's a problem. And, yeah, that seems kind of reasonable. But, you know, in Fishkin's case, it does seem to me that, you know, another person who's run deliberative polls, that he often has something of a liberal bias. You know, he wants I shouldn't just sort of allege this, but this is my impression that he's more pleased when the opinions move in a certain direction than others. So I guess the foundational question there is, how do we know when we're doing these experiments what we actually want when it's not a factual question? Because democracy often seems to just involve people coming together to figure out what they want, to figure out what their preferences are as a collectivity.
Sure. And it's a broader problem than just democracy, right? So how many companies will hire consultants to run reports on what strategy the company should be pursuing, how they should be doing a restructuring, what product markets they should be looking at, any of these kinds of things. And then if the report accords with what powerful people within the organization already believed, then it's taken up and given as reason for doing the thing that they wanted to do. And if it doesn't, then it gets binned and ignored. So knowing what people actually want is part of the problem. So again, going back to prediction markets, one of the hopes for these had been not just in a democratic realm in trying to figure out what effective policies will be, and I'll have to come back to explain these things a little bit more, but one of the hopes for them had also been that they would find favor within corporates. So when iPredict was set up in New Zealand, and this can be my way of explaining what a prediction market is, iPredict was run out of Victoria University at Wellington through VicLink. It was a real money exchange where people could trade futures contracts that depended on whether an event happened or not. So some of them were binary contracts, like pays $1 if the unemployment rate is higher than 5.5% as of date X, right? That's a 0-1 contract. And people go into that with real money. They trade on that. They can put up bids to buy, asks to sell, and the prices in those markets reflect then probabilities. And what work had been done on them at VIC showed that they're pretty accurate. So if a contract was tended to trade at about 50 cents over the life of the contract, well, it tended to pay out at a dollar about half the time, which is about as often as you'd expect it to. And similarly, a contract that traded around 30 cents would pay off at about one third of the time. A contract that would pay at 75 cents would pay out at a dollar three quarters of the time. The things ran on the smell of an oily rag, mainly because they'd hoped when they set it up that a lot of corporates are going to want to take this up for projecting sales, forecasting their market share compared to others, forecasting global prices for their commodities if they weren't traded in international futures markets, getting a company-based assessment on whether the strategy is going to work. So one of the problems that managers can have is getting truth out of their employees, right? So if you ask your team, well, when is this project going to be delivered? How can you trust what they tell you? Like, you can hold them to a deadline, but then it might fall over and they might be glossing things when they're telling you how long it's going to take to get something done or whether a project will ship or not. They might even just be deceiving themselves about it because nobody wants to admit if something's going wrong. Run it as a prediction market. You get real money bets within the company on whether the thing's going to work or not. Uptake of these things has been abysmal. And it's not because the things aren't accurate. It's because largely there isn't that much real demand for knowing this stuff.
Right. I mean, I guess, you know, the predictions markets are, well, they're concerned with the prediction of events. It seems to me that what you want in a democratic context is something slightly different, which is a mechanism of determining average preference or something like that, and then expressing that in a way that yields it through government. So something along those lines.
Well, it's two things simultaneously. You are expressing your values about what outcomes you consider to be desirable, simultaneously to expressing a view about which policies are likely to lead to those outcomes. And there can be a substantial disconnect between those, right? So you can value outcome X and think that policy R is the right way of achieving it when in fact it's just going to be abysmal. Those things should be separated. Prediction markets would be very good on establishing whether a policy is likely to lead to the kinds of outcomes that its proponents claim. It won't tell you whether those outcomes are good or not or how to weigh those outcomes against other potential good things, but they'll at least give you some baseline information on whether the policy is actually a good idea or whether it just feels ideologically good.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay, so and one of the mechanisms. So one of the reasons why you think prediction markets will be better is partly because when it comes to placing money on something, the voter then has an incentive to find out good information about it, right? So I've heard you use this information if you're arguing with someone about a rugby game in a bar and they say Wales is going to win, and you say, okay, do you want to put $10 on that? And they think, wait a minute, I'm not so sure about that. Maybe they were just saying it sort of performatively. So in this report, you do have some ideas about how we might incentivize citizens to find out more about the political system. Do you want to just talk about that?
So I was modifying an idea that Brian Kaplan had on just ways of improving the return to having the basic kind of civic knowledge that's necessary for the very basic function that you might want voters to be able to exercise in throwing the bums out if they need to be thrown out. So that requires, one, knowing who the bums are, and two, whether they should be thrown out. if you don't even know who the incumbents are, you're going to have problems with that. When I looked at the New Zealand election survey data, this is over a decade ago, you're finding people who, like during the Helen Clark administration, thought that National was in office, right? Mm-hmm. You get stuff like that. And if they're that mistaken, you can't throw the bums out because you're punishing the wrong people. You don't know who the incumbents are. So you need to have some way of making there be a real positive personal direct payoff for knowing stuff that's important for the democratic process, because there are these voter on voter externalities where if I'm severely mistaken and I vote, well, I'm unlikely to change the outcome. But if I do change the outcome, the costs of that are magnified across everybody. The way that Kaplan had suggested was, well, you could run a little civics test and just give people money if they get the right answer. No punishment at all if they don't get the right answer, but like give them 10, 20 bucks if on voting day they write a basic civics test. Here's your 20 bucks for getting the right answers. And actually, we're going to put both the questions and the answers in the newspaper for like months ahead of time so everybody can study for it and get free money. If you do that, then, well, you've got a positive incentive to actually know who's currently in government. Maybe you could have questions keying to current economic or social outcomes and whether they're better or worse than they were 5 years ago, things like that. You'd want to have somebody like the Electoral Commission setting that up. I'd suggested doing it a little bit differently, where you'd have just effectively a national lotto on it. You could register with the Electoral Commission, put your phone number on your name along with your name on the electoral roll. That part would never get published for others. It'd just be held for the Electoral Commission. Every day, a lucky caller would be called. They'd be asked some of the skill testing questions that had been published every day in the newspaper. Which party is currently represented by the Prime Minister? Or the Prime Minister is a member of which party? If they can answer that, here's $10,000. Like that'd be great, right? It'll give you some reason to know which party currently holds office. You can have a set of these questions. Get them right, get $10,000. Run that for 365 days in an election year. It still doesn't cost that much, right? One person gets it, but imagine getting the call and, oh, crud, I don't know who the Prime Minister is. I don't know which parties are in opposition and which ones are part of the governing coalition, if there's a governing coalition. I don't know who's more to blame for current inflation rates, the Reserve Bank or Treasury. Just getting the basic structures wrong would be embarrassing because you've lost 10 grand and you have to tell your family, oh, I got the call and I forgot one of the questions that's been in the newspaper every day and has been on radio ads.
But I mean, you're counting on the financial incentive being your main incentive, right? Not the shaming thing. Because there's also a version of this where you just go in a private sort of booth and you answer questions on a questionnaire about basic political knowledge and you get the money that way, right?
Yeah, you can do it that way too. So,
either way you do it, though, it's important that this solution or this suggestion is consistent with one person, one vote. So, you know, there are people who think that democracy works better if more informed people vote more or have more power. So John Stuart Mill notoriously thought this. And back in the day in England, you could actually get two votes by being a member of a university. So Oxford University, for example. So this isn't like that, right?
It's not just back in the day. It went through like 1950.
Right. I think in Ireland, they still have university constituencies but I don't know exactly how it works. But anyway, so what's one of the good things about this suggestion is that you're incentivizing people to know more, which presumably most people will think is a good thing, but you're not actually punishing people for not knowing stuff, especially not in the way of, you know, actually disenfranchising them or even reducing the power of their vote.
Yeah, that's an advantage of this system for those who consider those things to be important. I agree.
It seems to be a good idea from the perspective of a baseline level of knowledge about how the system works and what the responsibilities of different agencies are and things like that. Of course, when people vote, we'd like them to take into account more than that. I mean, there's a great deal more policy that they might want to know about.
Sure, but lower your expectations, man. If you look at what people actually know and what they care about, you're going to wind up being pretty disappointed. The most that you might be able to hope for is that people can adequately recognize who to punish when they get to the ballot box if they don't like what's going on out the window.
Well, I guess I suppose that's right, because they'll have a gut knowledge of what's going on out the window, or more likely in their hip pocket, if inflation is high, if there are things going wrong in their lives as a result of public policy, then they would like to punish the government. I guess as long as they know who the government is, then they'll be in a position to do that. So I guess that makes sense.
It's helpful on those grounds. You could want an awful lot more. I still like prediction markets are figuring out the which policies are more likely to be effective, and then the prices in those markets potentially informing voters about which kinds of policies they should support, and then politicians hopefully picking up the ones that are more likely to be effective towards the ends that the parties claim to value. I predict was pretty good during the era that it operated, but I didn't see much evidence that it was helping political parties move towards better policies. But we didn't get that far in policy markets. It was still fairly early when the thing got killed.
I think you can understand my concerns, though, that these things are a desire. So we desire for citizens to have greater knowledge of the political process, but these are not conditions for voting, because my worries are related to, for example, you know, during the Jim Crow era in the American South, there were literacy tests, and these were widely viewed as ways of keeping out blacks from voting. I mean, maybe that's sort of an exaggerated fear because of what happened then, but it does seem to me that, you know, for example, if you had these tests, one suggestion I think someone made was to have these tests in polling booths, and obviously that's very different to what was happening under Jim Crow, but I think that might still sort of, you might argue that could intimidate someone going into the polling booths. They might be less likely to vote if they thought there's going to be some kind of a test that I'm going to have to do or even be encouraged to do. What do you think about those kinds of worries?
Well, it's important to remember as well what was actually going on in the Jim Crow era. It wasn't just that there were literacy tests in an era in which it was very difficult for U.S. blacks to access formal education. It was also that illiterate whites would be given a free pass through by officials at the polling booth who'd whisper the answers to them, right? Mm-hmm. So it was made to look neutral, but was specifically intended to disenfranchise blacks. Now, whether you'd have the same objection to a system that were completely neutrally run and had like a computer administer a multi-choice test and provide, well, if you got all your answers right, maybe you've got 3 votes. And if you've got none of your answers right, maybe you've got half a vote. Whether those same objections would come into that kind of a system, well, there'd be a different set of objections.
I think similar objections come in if you're going to weight the influence someone has on the basis of the results. I mean, for one thing, it might not be on the basis of ethnicity, although in New Zealand it's likely to be, because I would say that the primary driver is socioeconomic, and some ethnic groups tend to be overrepresented in amongst the poor, and people with lower educational success and so on. And I guess it's a moot question, but, you know, to me, one of the things that keeps us cohesive as a society is the fact that, at least in theory, everybody has equal political influence. And if you start to mess with that, then you're giving some people, especially people who are already more powerful because they have more money and more education, more political power as well. I would worry about where that would head.
Well, the main effect would be to award extra votes to Green Party voters, because in all the work that I'd been doing on civic knowledge, now this is a little bit out of date and I've not looked at the most recent New Zealand election surveys, those who supported the Green Party had more civic knowledge than basically any other political party. So that
even ACT supporters?
I would have to double check on that, but I remember the Greens having been ahead of the rest of the pack.
I mean, I would have predicted that minor party supporters would do better, simply because to be a minor party supporter, you're more likely to take an active interest in politics.
Yeah, I think there is some evidence that intellectuals are more polarized, basically. You're more likely to be a Marxist and you're more likely to be a libertarian. But what you said there about that your survey in 2020 found that the Greens were more likely to be informed about politics, that's correct. I mean, I just remember reading this a few hours ago. So
I was remembering specifically the stuff in the New Zealand election survey because I'd done more formal academic work on that, but yeah.
Okay, so that's great. It's a really interesting conversation. Much more to be said on that topic. I wonder if we could turn to something that sort of more directly concerns free speech. And this is something else you've written on extensively, not only in reports, but also in columns, which is, well, online content regulation, but also sort of more generally the regulatory environment for speech. So I wonder whether I could just ask something quite sort of very, very broad to start off with, which is, what do you make at the moment of the online content regulation for New Zealand? Is it very liberal? Is it, you know, very conservative? What's it like to be in New Zealand and to want to express yourself online?
Well, right now it's still pretty fine. There are still worse places. We don't have U.S. First Amendment protections, but I'm reasonably outspoken. I've not had the police banging on my door complaining about a column that I've written. And to the extent that I self-censor, it's not around legal constraints. So I just don't want to, well, you want to be polite and polite company, right? So that's been fine. Some aspects are restrictive. The content regulation around films has been a little heavy-handed. It's not affected me directly, but at one point I'd almost had something I'd written for a newspaper, for a magazine, almost wound up being classified as objectionable by the censor's office. So I'd had, I think it was called High Times, the cannabis magazine. I'd done a little short review of Burrell's cost of harmful drug use report and just apportioning out what bits were actually cost of law enforcement and cost of prohibition as compared to cost of drug use. So that was in the cannabis magazine. And they just about considered that whole magazine objectionable because it had some column that was talking a little bit more about how to grow things. And that is something that gets considered objectionable in New Zealand. One of the weird bits, the penalties on possession of materials that the chief censor considers objectionable, which are basically never enforced unless something really weird happens, but they're still looming in the background, right?
Yeah.
So had that been considered objectionable, I probably would have had to have turned myself in for possessing a copy of it, because the weirdness of it is that it's objectionable even before the censor decides on it. Like, it was always objectionable and the censor just discovers or like puts the label on it, but it was objectionable even before the censor had labeled it as such. So I would have been in trouble for having a copy of the magazine that I had, that had a short article in. So that is pretty silly. You can also get into trouble for officially legally if you take your kid to an R13 movie. Well, you wouldn't be able to get them into the cinema, but if you watch at home on a DVD, it's been rated R13 by the censor, the kid's 12, you consider the kid's up for it, but maybe the 14-year-old who isn't should just go to bed. Well, that is also something that can get you in trouble if the censor's office decides to make an issue of it. Just might make a whole lot of sense, and neither does it make sense that the upcoming terrorism legislation that's being proposed that the Free Speech Union has commented on puts into the Terrorism Act that possessing an objectionable publication is a terrorist activity. Like, come on. This is like some Japanese anime comic books that, well, a little racy, get considered objectionable. And then forever after, you'd have to say on like a U.S. Customs declaration, yes, I have been convicted for a terrorism offense. Like, come on. It's just stupid.
You might think that you could take the position that it should be laws against both these things, objectionable material and terrorism, but that nonetheless they're separate.
To conflate them is well, purely absurd. I suspect, and I don't know where it's come from, has to do with the banning of Brenton Tarrant's awful manifesto. This is the man who murdered Muslims in Christchurch, and his, I mean, it is thoroughly objectionable. I don't agree that it should have been banned, because I think we should know what makes him tick or what kind of motivated him. I think it really helps us to analyze documents like that in order to really understand the driving forces behind terrible events like that. So, but I suspect that's why they're conflating these things, because there seems to be a level of discourse in this country at the moment which is a little bit overheated about the dangers of various, you know, so-called extremist groups or extremist people.
Well, sure. I have no urge to read the Tarrant Manifesto. Probably better not to. The guy has enough infamy. He shouldn't get any more. But you shouldn't make it illegal. Like, you can buy Mein Kampf, and then that's even worse, right?
Right.
The infamy, like the not giving him more infamy argument seems to apply to lots and lots of arguments over free speech, right? Because anytime you shut someone down, you're doing that. So if you wanted to argue that we need to shut down, you know, this people that we don't like getting more attention, then you'd end up shutting down a lot of things.
I'm not talking about this in a legal sense or in any way that I'd want to bind others. But when media publications decided that they didn't want to name the guy for a while, that didn't bother me any. Some people do decide that they want to do this to get their name out there. And if a newspaper decides that it doesn't want to provide that fame, that doesn't bother me at all. The newspaper can come to its own decision. I don't like the idea of making it illegal. And some of the name suppression orders that do come in, I find objectionable. But as a decision personally not to name, that's something entirely different.
Sure. But is it? It seems to me a very infantilizing move to say that people shouldn't read this some kind of worry that they might be influenced by it. I mean, I read it before it was banned, and it's certainly unhinged, and it's riddled with, well, error, to put it mildly, and it certainly isn't fun to read. But I do think that it's important for us to understand as much as we can about that kind of mentality, and certainly banning things is not going to help.
Sure. I've got no urge to read it, but I would hope that those who would profit from doing so for the purposes that you've discussed would be able to do so. Now, there's complicated procedures for getting legal access to it, but that's nonsense.
Yeah.
Okay, let's talk about Klingon flags. You wrote an article recently, it's on the New Zealand Initiative website, where I think that some people in, where was it, Wanaka, got investigated by the police because they were flying a flag of the Klingon Empire. Which obviously, you know, spoiler alert for people out there, the Klingon Empire doesn't really exist. It's from Star Trek. And someone reported them because they thought it was a white supremacist symbol?
Yeah, this was kind of a fun one. So stepping back a little bit further, the UK has gone overboard in some of their hate speech legislation, and that's led to just weird stuff where people get a knock on the door from the police because someone else was offended by a tweet. Like, not a tweet that was threatening death or violent, threatening physical harm or anything that would hit into the normal standards for, yeah, the police has to come and talk to this guy, but
it's normally just along the lines of saying a man can't magically turn into a woman or something like that.
Yeah, that sort of thing. So I've been hoping that that sort of thing doesn't creep into New Zealand. So it was then a bit of a worry when there was a newspaper report, and it was put kind of in the humor section of the newspaper, right? And it was written in a very jokey manner that there had been a report of a racist flag being flown, and when the police checked into it, it was a flag of the Klingon Empire, and then everybody just had a good laugh. It's not really for the police to be knocking on people's doors, even if it was an evil flag, right? Now, parts of the Klingon Empire, if we want to get really technical about it, was pretty evil at some points in its history.
Probably racist.
No, I stand against the Klingon Empire, definitely.
Well, they did join the Federation later, between the Spock era and Kirk from the original series, and then to the Next Generation. There's about a couple centuries there.
They change quite a lot, don't they, the Klingons, over time?
They've become much nicer.
Well, they've maintained some of their cultural authenticity while being a little bit less oppressive. But anyways, leaving all that aside,
they do quote Shakespeare in one of the movies, I remember, which perhaps that's appropriation, though. So
I'm sure Shakespeare has been translated into Klingon by somebody.
Picard is very literate and a fan of all that stuff,
Anyway, I mean, the case in the UK, what you're talking about there, I think, well, what Michael was talking about was, I think he was called Harry Miller, who posted some limericks which were perceived to be transphobic, and the police, I think, called him up.
They knocked on his door.
In some cases, they knock on your door.
And they told him he'd been, you know, accused of a hateful utterance on Twitter, and that it was to be recorded as a non-crime hate incident.
That's right, a non-crime hate incident. So when people highlight these issues, you know, the police investigated this person or the police called this person, often you get this counter-argument, well, actually, they weren't put in jail, they weren't punished, they were just recorded as a non-crime hate incident. So what's the problem with that? The Klingon, people flying the Klingon flag, the police just came. Police are friendly. What's the problem with the police?
See, we don't know what happened there, right? If the police just drove by to see what the hell was going on, saw it was a Klingon flag, had a laugh, never knocked on the door, and just went back and told the journalists about it, that's all fine so long as it wouldn't have been a knock on the door in the absence of there being some other really good reason to do that. So if there were a Nazi flag and some reason to think that there were about to do a lot of other bad things, that'd be different. But getting knocks on the door from the police is itself intimidating, right? You've got an agent of the state that's come in uniform and who has powers to do things to you. That process itself is a form of punishment.
Of course it is, and it renders completely silly the argument that no punishment is present, because actually a knock on the door from the police and a warning like that is punishment.
Yeah,
and I would hope actually that in the absence of other evidence of wrongdoing, the police would ignore a call to go and investigate a flag of any kind.
Well, that would have been the right response, right? The police, on getting the call, could have said, "Flying flags isn't illegal. Why are you calling us?"
Yeah, It's kind of reminiscent of, you know, the free speech debate, the debate about free speech on university campuses, because there too you have these investigations, which often don't, or, you know, 9 times out of 10, they don't go anywhere and people don't get fired or they don't get, you know, demoted or anything. But they have to go through this whole process, and often that can be quite nerve-wracking and even expensive in itself if you have to pay lawyers' fees.
Yeah. So. Process can be the punishment.
Yeah. So where is online content regulation going in New Zealand? Because I remember in the UK, around the time of Theresa May, there was an effort to use these sort of behavioral economics nudge techniques, for example, with regard to pornography. So I think the plan there was that they were going to make people sign up if they wanted to access porn, you know, just sort of regular porn. We're not talking about child porn here, but, you know, looking at porn, you'd have to sort of sign a form or something. And they were saying here too, you know, the reason why it was a nudge technique was they weren't saying we're going to ban pornography or particular types of pornography beyond the obvious ones like child porn. We're just going to get you to sign your name. So what's the problem with that? That's not liberal, right?
Yeah, that's funny. So you'd mentioned the nudge theory. So I'm not sure if this has come up before on the podcast, but I've not listened to all the episodes. But it comes down to some prior theory from Cass Sunstein and Richard Thaler. Thaler's an economist. Sunstein's across everything, but he's mainly a lawyer, a legal academic. And in the nudge theory, you can preserve liberty a bit more by providing a default option that's in line with whatever the state thinks best, because the state may be able to better tell what that is, and then giving people an opt-out. So the idea then in the UK, and I was really worried about this stuff and saw all kinds of opportunities for mischief in it, and I'd occasionally pester Thaler about it, but other better critics have as well, like Mario Rizzo and Glenn Whitman. Thaler and Sunstein insisted that wouldn't happen, and they'd call it bathymophobia, this fear of slippery slopes. So when the UK nudge unit ends up recommending that, well, we could just set an age filter for porn where you have to opt in, like go onto this opt-in list that you want your house to be allowed to access pornography through the internet. Well, it's an opt-out in some sense, but it's also forcing an awful lot of costs and discussions within a household that might not even be welcome, right? Some things might just be implicit and best never discussed. And forcing the discussion can itself be costly. And that is something that Thaler himself pointed out. He said, this isn't a nudge. This is imposing costs in that kind of a way, and it's illiberal and unwelcome.
I have two further objections, which are both related to being imposed by the state. The first is you're forced to identify yourself to the state as somebody who wants to access something that the state has just told you is undesirable.
Exactly.
So that's not a comfortable situation. The other one is, why is the state the arbiter of what is desirable in the first place rather than the body politic?
Yeah, so about five or six years ago, I think it was Family First that had come up with its own video streaming network, and I don't know whether it's still going or not, but they were wanting to put up a streaming content service for Christian families that wanted to ensure that there was only appropriate material for their that they considered appropriate for their families on the streaming service. Like, that kind of option is wonderful. Like, I wouldn't subscribe to that service, but that makes a heck of a lot more sense than a censor coming in and saying, well, if you want stuff that's beyond those kinds of offerings, you need to sign these forms, and maybe some future government will do terrible things to people who have signed this form.
Mm-hmm. Okay, this is going to be a beautiful segue to our final topic, because I saw in your blog, Offsetting Behavior, by the way, if anyone wants to go check out Eric's blog.
We'll put a link on the podcast.
Put it in the description, yeah. So I read there that some academics from the Otago School of Public Health suggested recently putting an R rating on films that feature smoking.
Yeah, that was a fun one from a few years. Well, this is a little bit older now, if I'm remembering correctly, but I'd have to check back. Yeah.
And of course, you know what they mean, right? Because smoking is bad. It's really, you know, that's very, very well established now. And so you see cool people or sexy people smoking in films, and that increases your likelihood to smoke. So that seems reasonable, right?
Well, not so much to me, but it is in line with a lot of the things that have come out of Otago Public Health on the smoking kind of vaping file. It's a little disappointing. I agreed with a lot of the Otago Public Health guys on communicable disease, like when we were going through COVID. To me, they made a lot of sense, and we can argue about that another time. But that's about something where I risk imposing costs on others if I'm actually infectious, right? That seems fundamentally different from smoking or anything where you're imposing costs on yourself, and then it's like this complicated decision within your head of how you think about your future selves and how you think about these costs.
Well, I suppose the argument might be that you're imposing costs on others through the health service. You get lung cancer, you're going to go to public hospitals and take up a bed and all that.
Yeah, that argument is generally lame. So I'll explain what I mean by that. There's two ways of approaching it. One, a technical economic way, and two, a political economy one. The technical one is technical, but there was work by Edgar Browning in Public Finance Review in 1999 that was showing that if you are trying to set a sequence of taxes and subsidies on products or behaviors that impose costs through the public health system, if you get things exactly perfectly right, you will have replicated the premiums that a private health insurer would be charging if you didn't have a public health system. Mm-hmm. Now, if that's what you want, why not just not have a public health system, have private insurance, and give poor people money so that they can afford private health insurance? That would be the better way of doing it. And then people can decide for themselves whether they want to engage in the behaviors and pay a higher insurance premium or not engage in the behaviors and get a lower insurance premium. That makes an awful lot more sense to me. That's the technical argument. The less technical argument and the more libertarian one, if I take off my straight econ hat and put on my libertarian-ish hat, it seems repugnant that you are, by virtue of being forced into a public health system from which you cannot opt out, you are simultaneously required to forego things that you find to be beneficial to avoid imposing costs through a health system that you didn't want to be a part of. If you're going to run that kind of a mechanism, you have to have an opt-out clause so that people can say, no, I would prefer to have none of these regulations facing me. Give me a little cut on my taxes for the proportion that would be covering the public health system, and I will buy my own health insurance. Leave me the hell alone.
So your agreement with the Otago people on COVID policy was motivated by the cost on potentially imposed on others in terms of infecting them with COVID, rather than the other argument which I've heard, which is the health system would become overloaded. If
it winds up being a bit of both, because in the COVID case, it seems fundamentally different from sort of normal stuff. So the normal drill in the public health system is, you can imagine it as this agreement that, okay, fine, we're going to socialize a lot of these costs and we're going to transfer the costs of covering some of these healthcare services. And we recognize that there will be some extra risks that are taken as consequence of this, but we're going to run a health system that can basically handle it. No health system would be able to handle the level of burden that would have been imposed on it as COVID ran through prior to vaccination. The whole thing would have fallen over, and it would have been unreasonable to expect the public health system to have been able to possibly scale up to meet that kind of demand. In that kind of a case, there is a real and direct externality that's imposed on others, and it's not just through the cost mechanism. So the technical thing that I described before, that was all running through a cost transfer framework where I'm engaging in behaviors that impose costs on you through the public health system because you're having to pay higher taxes. And that's what we call a pecuniary externality. If instead it means the health system is going to fall over and you can't get treatment for a heart attack because the whole thing is clogged up, that's not just affecting me through the tax system. It's also meaning that I'm potentially dead because I can't access any health services at all because the health system wouldn't have had time to scale up to deal with that. So I think that the sort of fiscal externality argument that is really worrying for sort of normal risks that we all know how to deal with and that the system should have scaled up to handle. On those grounds, it's just pecuniary and you shouldn't worry about it. When it comes into these new things that impose massive sudden risk that the health system couldn't possibly deal with, then it becomes real technological direct effects on others, and that's more substantial. Mm. Now, the where we'd opened up with this was on smoking, though, and its visualization in movies. So you're seeing more and more of this and policy that's based on it. Now, the Otago people's asking that you rate R anything that's got smoking in it. Well, one, it would make it illegal for me to watch any old cartoons with my kids that had like a cartoon character with a cigar.
James Bond's out.
Yeah. And I recently gone through all the Bond films with the kids.
Also Pinocchio.
Right.
Yeah. All kinds of things become illegal that are manifestly unjust to make illegal. It's just stupid. You can't do that.
Lord of the Rings, they're smoking pipes constantly.
Yeah, we never quite specified what pipe weed is.
Well, no.
Still smoking.
Jackson made implications that Tolkien didn't in that regard, but We won't go there.
Just because we don't know what that is doesn't mean that it doesn't have harms that we haven't found out about yet.
It might have benefits.
Precautionary principle.
Yeah, right. So the idea in the Otago approach there was sort of denormalization, that you don't want people seeing this as a normal activity so that they don't grow up in that culture, they're not exposed to it. And there's been a whole pile of work that the Ministry of Health through the Public Health Granting Agency has funded Otago to do on this kind of stuff. Like they've run studies that have cost millions, lots and lots of money, where they put like cameras on kids to see how many brands they're exposed to for things that are deemed objectionable, like alcohol labels, right? Or sugary cereals, whatever. All of that is based on this idea that normalization leads to behaviors that the public health people might not want people engaging in. Now, most of this has not cashed out into liberty deteriorating policy as yet, but in some aspects it has. Just this past week, Wellington Council issued new directions saying that if you're a restaurant or a bar that is leasing space on the sidewalk for outdoor dining or outdoor drinking, then those spaces, you're going to be prohibited from allowing smoking or vaping in those places. Bars and restaurants are still allowed to have their own outdoor separate smoking area that has to be outdoors as defined in the Act, which gets complicated and messy. Banning smoking and vaping on the sidewalk that's being used for those activities, just one, it's bad because there's no real harms that are imposed directly. Secondhand smoke is bad if you're in an enclosed environment for a very prolonged period of time. The best evidence on it comes out of surveys from, I think it was from the 1950s, where they were looking at the lung cancer rates for Japanese housewives of smokers. Mm. Now, if you're with somebody all the time and they're a heavy smoker and you're indoors, well, you're going to experience harms from secondhand smoke. But then it turns into rules around smoking in cars, even if you have the windows open, and into rules about being seen to be smoking or even vaping. And the rules on vaping and smoking in cars also apply to vaping.
It's hard to imagine that secondhand vape has any effect.
No, it doesn't. People might find the smell objectionable. But
someone's perfume or deodorant, perhaps,
or just their natural natural aroma, right? Mm-hmm. Some people have an unpleasant natural aroma. We wouldn't want to ban them from being in restaurants, although a restaurant might choose to not allow them in.
Right. So, like, I don't like Welsh rugby fans or something. So, I, yeah, you know, that's not a reason to sort of introduce a law saying there can be no pubs which allow Welsh rugby fans. It's much better for me to think, oh, I won't go to that particular pub. I'll go to another one.
Well, yeah, these sorts of things should be left to the discretion of the venue owner or manager, delegated by the owner, in setting the kind of venue that they want to be running, right? So every bar and restaurant and pub, they're trying to come up with their own sort of vibe, the feel to the place, what kind of clientele they are currently serving, what kind of clientele they'd like to attract. A lot of effort goes into this. Some places could decide that they want to be the very vape-friendly bar and allow that indoors, and people who would go in there would know what they're getting into, right? You wouldn't go in there if you hated the smell of vape.
This was my view when they banned smoking in bars.
And it's still
These are private establishments. The idea that smoking ought to be banned there by the state is basically saying people have a right to go into any private establishment they like, which is not true, surely.
Also, if you have a reasonably good competitive environment, then the amount of or the number of establishments which had smoking and non-smoking would presumably adjust over time, so that it reflected the distribution of preferences in the society. You know, so
sure.
So I would predict that, you know, if they'd done that around whenever they brought in the smoking ban in England, I think it was 2006, instead of just banning it outright, then you probably would still have seen a reduction in the number of cafes and pubs which allowed smoking, just because over time, you know, fewer and fewer people
wanted to do and be around it. Yeah.
Yeah. The best argument in favor of the regulations was a health and safety one around the workers. But even that seems troublesome for me, where people have choices of employers. They have choices of different kinds of work conditions. There are lots of work environments that are riskier than secondhand tobacco smoke. Not all of those are banned. Some of them are regulated. You could come up with less intrusive ways of handling this. You could imagine air quality standards that might be more effective. I put in a submission on the latest round of anti-smoking rules that came through. And at the end of it, the legislation is nuts. I don't know whether you want to get into that. It's this whole separate category of thing. But it made the suggestion there that really, if this is about health, and if you're looking in part at trying to improve health outcomes, why not reconsider some of the bans on indoor vaping and possibly smoking if you could meet an air quality standard where you're checking that you filtered the air against tobacco smoke? And really, if you're doing that, it won't cost you that much more to put in a HEPA filter instead of just a normal filter, so you're also filtering out COVID, right? So government has been pretty, this part actually drives me insane. We've got all of these rules about smoking in bars, which is basically harmless. Like, I could sit next to a smoker in a bar all night for a month, and it's not going to do any particular harm. It just takes one puff of COVID to get COVID. And there's basically no rules on that anymore. We could have had an air quality standard. They've had no regulation on air quality for that. They've had tons of regulation on air quality for cigarettes. Now, I can imagine very good reasons the government would not want to progress those regulations. It could just be not cost effective. And that would totally make sense.
Well, I think what this very rational approach misses is that the real reason for banning smoking in bars is not to stop people being harmed by secondhand smoke, but to dissuade people from smoking altogether.
Oh, sure. That's always been part of it, punishing the smokers, right? Force them out into the rain, force them out into the cold, put up ads that make them seem to be miserable people. Demonizing smokers has been a big part of it. I completely agree. If we wanted to pursue a public health outcome, though, and especially if we're in a pandemic, just imagine allowing bars to be friendly to smokers and vapers again, if they were filtering the air to a quality that meant there was no possible harm to others from the secondhand smoke, and also, by the way, got rid of COVID.
And presumably other diseases while you're
at
it.
Well, yeah. I'd be loving going. I would strictly prefer to go to those bars and restaurants, and they would have a positive reason to put in that kind of air filtration, which can be expensive, but they would be able to attract a different clientele compared to others. They'd have a profit-based reason for doing it. And that's a lot better, in my view, than setting blanket rules on everybody that would mandate coming up to that standard, which could be, with just the straight econ hat on, you'd want to do a serious cost-benefit on it to see if it made sense. It's plausible that it could, but I haven't run the numbers. Easing the rules that are already in place so that some could opt into that if they wanted, to me, makes a lot of sense.
Okay, maybe just a final question then. Recently in a column, you wrote that you might join the pirates. Can you explain that?
Oh, that's, again, following on from the current smoke-free legislation. So the legislation that I was submitting on that I was talking about before has a few aspects to it that are pretty objectionable. So the first and worst one is a denicotization rule where only cigarettes or tobacco that have very low nicotine content will be allowed for sale in the New Zealand market. I think it's an 8 milligram rule, but I have to check back on the content. It was getting it down to a level that was comparable to the near beer levels that were allowed during U.S. prohibition. So U.S. alcohol prohibition, which led to crazy black market activity, all the gangsters. During that era, beer wasn't illegal so long as it had less than 0.5% alcohol. It was called a near beer. Now, surprisingly enough, a lot of people who like beer didn't want to buy that. They wanted to buy what Al Capone had instead.
Yeah.
Right? So if you allow only very low levels of nicotine in cigarettes, you are effectively having prohibition of cigarettes with a near cigarette exemption. The main difference between U.S. prohibition on alcohol and New Zealand prohibition on cigarettes is that vaping is here legal. There is no comparable thing to vaping in the U.S. during the prohibition era for alcohol. So what we don't know is going to happen then is when that prohibition comes through, are those who are currently smokers going to stick with no nicotine cigarettes because they like the taste of them? Doesn't seem that likely to me, but it's an empirical question. Will they flip to the illicit market, which has been growing substantially? If you look at the number of customs seizures, you can look at the latest Customs New Zealand annual report. They give the excise value of seizures that they've had going back the last 5-7 years, something like that. And it's following a nice exponential curve up. Some might switch to the black market and some might switch to vaping. To the extent that they switch to vaping, that would be in line with the government's health objectives. To the extent that they switch to the illicit market, it wouldn't, and it would make it even less likely that they're going to switch over to vaping afterwards, because right now cigarettes are crazy expensive. That's because right. of excise, and illicit tobacco carries no excise.
And I think in that there's a clue to the answer to your question, which is that they're going to be more likely to go to the black market than to vaping, because they could go to vaping now and save a whole lot of money and get just the same nicotine hit. So there's obviously something about smoking that they like enough to keep doing that, even though they know it's more harmful to their health and much more expensive.
Yeah, that is my baseline expectation of what'll happen. The argument from the other side would be that, well, you can get these status quo behaviors and people just get habituated to doing something, and you need a sharp break to force a decision. Some people who haven't been reached yet by vaping, once they're forced to make a decision, will flip over to vaping. It's an empirical question to see how the hell that turns out. But I expect that it's going to strengthen the black market. And to the extent that it is then that it becomes illegal to get a proper cigarette, I'm cheering for the smugglers who are actually satisfying demand.
All right. That was great. So we're all on the side of the pirates, I think, on that one. Thanks very much, Eric, for joining us.
Thanks indeed.
Thanks for having me.